The worst thing you could do, in my opinion, is to listen to people on YouTube or podcasts and just take their word for it. You got to try this stuff.
Yeah, and have a strong opinion that's loosely held. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, if you come along across a new functionality or a new paradigm that you prefer better, switch.
Today, I'm joined by Michael Green. He's the author of Zero to Pi. He has a PhD in chemistry and made a transition to back-end web development. Michael, do you want to take just a second and introduce yourself?
So my name is Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. My background getting into web development comes from a scientific computing background. So I started out in academia. Most of my computing experience comes from doing scientific computing for materials analysis. And as I was going through that process of getting my PhD, I figured out, or I came to the conclusion that I was having a lot of fun with the work that I was doing, developing these ETL pipelines for doing materials analysis. And it wasn't that big of a jump to go from the scientific computing domain that I had started into web development, where I am now actually building ETL pipelines for the current company that I work for.
Okay, so for the listeners, I'm really excited for this episode of Backend Banter because I think there's going to be more backend banter in the episode than there normally is, because Michael and I have had some Twitter discussions and we actually disagree on some stuff, which to be honest, like, I think is fantastic, especially for like students going through boot dev. They kind of get all of my opinions through a fire hose, but I love the idea of everyone listening to this podcast getting to hear kind of the other take. So super excited about that. But it's really interesting to hear that we have such a similar background. You know, I did a lot of Python in school. Obviously, you're the author of Zero to Pi. You've done a lot of Python. I've done mostly Go in my kind of professional experience. But a lot of that work was in ETL pipelines. And so we kind of have that similarity in our professional background. Can you explain to the audience, just kind of really high level overview, what is an ETL pipeline?
So yeah, an ETL pipeline, the ETL stands for extract, transform, and load. Basically, what you're trying to do is you're trying to build this pipeline that you have data that comes in at one source and you need to load it into your process, do some extraction, do some transformation on that data, and then send it out to some other service that allows you to do, like, for my example, when I was in grad school, I was doing a lot of analytics based off of the data that we were ingesting from these ancient machines that were just spewing out CSV files. So where, you know, the work that I do now is pretty similar. We take in these CSV files from API endpoints and we do some data transformations to get them to work with our backend servers. And then we do analytics based off of the resultants of those transformations.
Yeah. Okay. Great explanation. I mean, in my experience, there's like two main things you do as a backend developer. It's like you build kind of CRUD APIs, right? So APIs that sit in front of like databases that allow clients of the APIs to like create, read, update, delete resources. Or you're building like ETL pipelines where you're slurping data from some source, doing some sort of interesting transformation on it, maybe even like computing some analytics on it and then shoving it somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the work that I do nowadays is hitting API endpoints, doing those transformations based off of internal schema that we require. Some third-party API is going to have a different schema, trying to translate those between the two and then send it off to some other service.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. During your PhD in chemistry, you'd done a lot with, was it the scientific stack in Python?
Yeah. So when I was getting started in my grad work, my professor literally came to me with a bunch of Excel files. It's like, hey, I have this 5x n sheet of data that we need to take from describing the electric and magnetic properties of materials. And we need to use that to compute this six-dimensional manifold of how this material will interact with electromagnetic radiation at different angles. And he was doing all this in Excel. And I was like, that's insane. I'm not doing that. So I got to figure out some other paradigm that would allow me to actually do these calculations. So I spent some time looking into some of the various paradigms that would allow you to do this kind of work. And Python stood out to me just because of its really simple syntax. You know, it gets you, it's not very hard to go from zero to one in terms of I know nothing to, okay, I can do something. Yeah. And then it also gives you this rich ecosystem of, okay, I know how to do a few things. Let me go ahead and see what else is available out there in the package ecosystem that I can leverage in order to actually do these calculations more efficiently. And it also provides a bunch of hooks that allow you to even, you know, push the compute even farther. You know, instead of doing all that compute in Python where math is really slow, you can push it down into the C layer and suddenly you're getting this raw C execution speed. Allows you to get from executing something that takes 45 minutes to something executing something that is like 20.
Yeah, sometimes it's insane how much the difference can be in those compute times. I remember even when I was studying C++ in college, I'd run a lot of times in Visual Studio, not Visual Studio Code, but Visual Studio in like debug mode versus mm-hmm. release mode for my C++ builds, and I was always blown away at the execution speed. Like I'm having a hard time remembering the exact numbers, but it was like at least an order of magnitude off. Like I'd be running some crazy calculation for like an algorithms course and it would take like 10 times as long if I forgot to switch into release mode, just because you don't get
I've seen algorithms that take like 6,000% faster if you just do it in C versus if you do it in Python. You know, at the end of the day, you want to pick the tool that's right for your job. If you're trying to ingest a CSV file, you're trying to load it into some sort of process, you know, you can do that in Python where it's like super, you're super dynamic and you're super expressive in the things that you can do with a CSV. But once you actually get down to actually crunching numbers, you just want to push it down into the C layer where you can actually get some real performance.
Yeah. So it warms my heart to hear that you were kind of in academia or at least in chemistry, right? A STEM field that's not programming. And that you found your way into the Python stack, because for a long time, it's kind of been like MATLAB, this proprietary programming language, has kind of had a stranglehold over like academia that is not computer science, right? Like the computer scientists were like sitting over here writing like C and Python and like quote unquote real programming languages. And like, I go talk to my like mechanical engineering, you know, father-in-law, it's like, he's only ever done anything in MATLAB. And I'm like, we need to bridge this gap. And from what I understand, a lot of universities are starting to use Python a lot more outside of the computer science department. And I love to see that, just because, you know, Python is like at the end of the day, a production ready programming language that you're actually going to deploy applications in, write scripts in, write automation with.
When I was an undergrad, I did a little bit of dabbling with the engineering department, specifically chemical engineering, and they did a lot of MATLAB. And when I was looking into it, it was like, oh God, I'm not paying $2,000. It's like, that's insane. So, you know, going back into grad school, wondering, you know, what kind of tools do other people use for this? There was MATLAB and it was like, no. And then there was this Python ecosystem that was free. It was open source. It just allowed you to just install the Python interpreter and get running.
Yeah. And like what I tell I have a brother-in-law who's currently studying engineering, electrical engineering in school. And he was like asking me like, should I do my projects in like MATLAB or Python? I was like, well, if you do them in Python, assuming you can like still pass the class, like you come out of that class with like an additional skill that's actually super useful.
And you're not throwing away in some license that you're now vendor locked. You know, you know, like you're going to spend $2,000 on a license and you're going to expect your company to actually spend money on maintaining that license so they can actually get access to the skill set that you have. Or you could just deal, you know, develop yourself in a skill set that is free and open source. You know, it seems like an obvious choice to me.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So, okay, me and you both love Python, but we love it a little differently. And that's where the banter is going to start. So, like, just to kind of set the stage a little bit, on Boot Dev, where obviously it's my website for kind of training up back-end developers, you can always think of it as like a CS degree online, but specifically tailored towards like a career path in back-end development. I start programmers in Python. And my reasoning behind that is I think Python is just a fantastic language to learn computer science fundamentals with. You don't have to be too concerned about syntax, right? The syntax really gets out of your way. It feels kind of like writing plain English. And so I really think like learning data structures and algorithms, learning object-oriented programming and stuff in the Python ecosystem is one of the best ways to get started. That doesn't mean you can't start in other languages, but I personally love starting people in Python. Where I start to not favor Python, or where I start to struggle with Python, is in like large projects, like production size projects. There's two reasons for that. The first is Python being a dynamically typed language. And that's the discussion that I think we should have first. And the second one is more about like performance and speed. But let's start there. So, you know, I last week wrote this article about how I really am not a fan of dynamic typing. I responded to DHH's article about dynamic types. Primogen then reacted to that article. And part of the problem is I don't actually know personally very many people who are fans of dynamic typing. Obviously DHH is, but I don't know him. I was just responding to his article. So I've had a hard time.
He didn't really make an argument in his article. You know, it was more like a, I feel like I like doing this, so I like doing this. And it's like, okay, it's circular. It's like, you're not going to argue with someone who's arguing based off feelings.
Yeah, a lot of times the proponents of dynamic typing just say something simple like, you know, I don't have to worry about types. I can just kind of write the code. And to a certain extent, I agree with that if your program is like tiny, 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 right? Like if it's just like 10 lines of script. But I struggle to see... So I want to jump right into your case for dynamic types.
Well, don't ever come work here because our backend is like 1.2 million lines of Python code.
God. All right.
So to preface the conversation, I think it would be improper to suggest that dynamicism versus static types is like a tautology. I don't necessarily think that dynamic types is always the answer versus static types. I think people prefer different workflows and generally have different ways of viewing software development. And to say that one is superior, always superior to the other, I think. That being said, I don't think that dynamic types are nearly as bad as everyone believes. It just requires adopting a workflow that's more complementary to the paradigm. So when we talk about a sound static type system, meaning a type system where type safety is an algebraic property that can be, you know, formally proven, that type system is enforcing a restriction on the set of possible operations that you can execute given a particular value or object. Even if an operation is possible, you are not allowed to execute that operation unless it fits the expected semantic definition of that given type. Let's take Go, for example. So Go provides a great deal of flexibility in terms of creating objects anonymously. The language supports both anonymous structs and anonymous functions, right?
Yeah.
So using these two constructs, you can do things like create entities like closures, where you wrap your enclosing state and your state inside an enclosing function, which now acts as your constructor. And from that function, you can return an anonymous struct, which defines fields as anonymous functions.
I want to pause you right here for just a second to throw down some definitions, because a lot of our listeners are pretty new to programming still. So let's just define a couple terms and then we'll continue. So first of all, structs, objects, we're kind of using those terms a little interchangeably. I think that's okay. But basically, collections of data, right? Like I could have a struct that represents a car. It might have like a tire size and a make and a model. So like when we say structs or objects, we're kind of talking about collections of data and behavior, right?
Sure. Like in Go, it's type, name, struct, braces, and then you have your methods and your attributes and your fields based off of that. But like you said, just a collection of data that you include in the struct, your fields, and then after the fact, you write out the methods in their own function, which I also don't like, but we can have that conversation later.
And then you also said anonymous functions and anonymous structs. And by that, we just mean a struct type definition or a function definition that is not named. We're kind of making it on the spot and creating it as a value within our program, like to be used, I mean, probably just once or twice, at least that's how it's been used in my experience. But realistically, what's happening is you're kind of defining it as data within your program. You can then like use the definition later or call the function later. Is that a fair enough definition?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair definition. Yeah, so you have these paradigms in Go that allow you to define these anonymous structures. And then on those structures, you can define even anonymous functions as fields in the struct. And since you have garbage collection on the back end handling your state persistence after the enclosing function returns, you get this nice object representation, which is functionally equivalent to a formal struct type with formal methods that people are used to. You know, you define your struct, this is your type, and then you define methods. They act the same thing. The API is the same. Now, the problem with this, however, is that there is no interface in Go that will allow you to pass that object around the call stack, because the Go spec does not allow for interfaces to type check against those struct fields, which are anonymous functions. It's not that the interface is different per se. The API you have for this closure object is the same API you would have for a proper type. But the Go's type system sets this arbitrary restriction regardless. So as you as a developer are limited in your expressiveness all for the sake of quote type safety.
First of all, I'm going to just like right up front make that concession. Like I completely agree. Generally speaking, our type systems are imperfect. Like in reality, they're imperfect. I have a hard time believing that like theoretically you couldn't keep making the type system more and more expressive and basically mitigate all the problems. But like, especially in Go, right? Go is famously a like feature-less language. It's a very simple language with very few features.
Sure, we can imagine a perfect paradigm where the type system is perfect and it lets you do all the things that you want. But at the end of the day, you are stuck with the type system that you have, and the type system that you have in Go is restricting you to a subset of the language that you could do otherwise.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. My main point is when I'm programming like large backend systems in Go, and keep in mind, I'm mostly talking about specifically backend systems here. The trade-off to me of like not being able to be as expressive in my metaprogramming versus having type safety at compile time. So knowing that like this struct has these fields, right? And that when I try to access them, they will be there. Or knowing that when I pass 10 different arguments into a function, like all of them are there, right? And the caller didn't just arbitrarily decide to pass a different amount of arguments to my function. It's like an order of magnitude difference in like importance to me as like from a productivity standpoint. But I think we could definitely agree that you do lose expressiveness the more restrictive the type system is. I'm not familiar enough with like the type system in Rust to be able to make the case for like the state of the world in Rust. But I will say that I know that it has many more features than Go. For example, I've talked a lot about how I wish Go had like pattern matching and enums like Rust has. I think that would allow for just much better modeling of the state of the world in the Go programming language. But the Go authors have like famously made this decision to be like, we're not shipping any features until we're like 1,000% sure that it's going to be super useful in production. Because in their experience, it was like, we have these languages with like feature bloat. And in order to get really proficient in the language, like for you to jump into a huge project as a new developer, it can be so overwhelming because there's just so many things about the language that you need to be familiar with.
And I get that. We've discussed the idea that static type system is a restriction on your expressiveness, but sometimes it might be a benefit in order to make sure that you have a complete feature set that is core to the things that you're actually trying to do. If you get rid of your type system, you get access to these more esoteric paradigms that you may want to use. You know, for example, I really like closures, but you know, the fact that I can't use struct fields of anonymous functions through the type system is a real barrier to that development paradigm. At the end of the day, the type system is going to restrict you from being able to do those things. And it's on you to decide whether or not you're okay with that.
Yeah, I agree. Let's just like bring it back to a specific domain. So like backend development, running in production, I would argue there's very few cases where you need a closure with anonymous functions in order to effectively communicate what you want your program to do.
Sure, that's fair. But you have to accept that you have to use the author's author of the programming language is his preferred paradigm, her preferred paradigm, instead of the paradigm that you would prefer to work in.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, programming languages are good at different things.
Let's cut this here and give the other side of the coin. Let's talk about dynamic typing for a second. So dynamic typing, on the other hand, is going to be the recognition that at the end of the day, we may not really care whether or not an object fits the semantic definition of a given type. We just care about whether or not we can do the things we want given the object. It's preferencing functionality over identity. And in Python, for example, you don't even have this concept, at least from the interpreter standpoint, of type checking. The interpreter is just going to run your code the way you said to run it. And it's your job to make sure that the operations you're calling for are supported by the object.
Yes.
So like you were saying, the response to that is, well, dynamic type languages, you know, dynamic languages don't guarantee the sort of type safety unless you run it. Is that correct?
Yes, but I want to like, I want to say correct, but maybe even just elaborate on a point that you made. I don't think that it's specific to dynamically typed or quote unquote duck typed languages that we just care about functionality rather than types, because that paradigm does exist in statically typed languages under the guise of interfaces and generics. So like you can get, I would argue, 98% or even 99% of that benefit in a statically typed language without making all the trade-offs. But yeah, go on.
But there's that limitation. So again, you gotta preference your values here, or you gotta pick your values here. Do you want the full expressiveness or do you want the type safety? And I'm gonna argue that the type safety, it is a valid intermediate step But at the end of the day, type safety is a subset of runtime safety. So, you know, like I was saying, you can't guarantee any sort of type safety in a dynamic language unless you run it.
Yes.
And the answer to that is, yeah, let's run it. And that's where this idea of testing comes to go. In dynamic languages like Python, it's super important to have good testing practices, because the way you prove that a piece of functionality is correct is by executing your code and making sure that your resultant state matches your expectations. And since, like I said, runtime safety is a superset of type safety, a test suite that generates results that match your expectations is by definition type. And sure, if you're working in a paradigm where it's not typically standard practice to have a robust testing framework alongside your application, you know, for example, like front-end web app development, a lot of times there aren't testing frameworks that people will use when they're slapping JavaScript together. Then sure, being able to annotate your data types and inferring your type safety across your application vis-a-vis TypeScript can be a benefit. But since we're backend developers here anyways, typically we have access to test suites to run our application against. And personally, I don't see a compelling enough reason to require both the intermediate type safety check as well as the runtime safety check when runtime safety via your test suite is going to provide you the same assurances on correctness that you get from the static type check.
I think it very simply comes down to an argument of developer experience and productivity. So In my experience, especially recently, because a lot of tooling has gotten a lot better in the last decade, but it is orders of magnitude faster to test using a type system than to actually write, like spend the labor and toil of writing unit tests to test a type system. I can get in editor line by line type testing for free by using static types. The trade-off is when you move to a dynamic type system, yes, you can like test for those things by writing unit tests, right? And making sure the properties exist on objects, but it's going to be 10 to 100 times as much work in order to get the same result. So like, if we're arguing about what's possible, I completely agree. You can get to that level of robustness, but in terms of like business productivity and expense, I don't think it's even close.
So we have a little bit of a disjoint here between what I'm trying to say and what you're picking up on.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that you would go around and turn around and test your types. I'm suggesting that you have the objects, you're going to use them as if they have a certain type. And the process of using them as if it is a certain type is the check that proves that your object is sufficiently enough of the type that you are trying to make use of. So for example, Python list. If I want to do a get item operation on a Python list, at the end of the day, as long as the object that I have supports that get item operation, it's going to execute. So you can think of the get item, you know, the square brackets as an interface that you are requesting that your object adhere to. And list types do that. So as you do a get item operation on your object that happens to be a list, the fact that it has that function definition on the type is proof enough that your object is list enough. You know, it's that old adage of duck typing. If it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, then it's sufficiently enough of duck. It's not that you're testing to make sure that this is a duck before you use it. It's you're going to use this thing like a duck, and if it blows up on you, you need to figure that out.
Yeah, and this like takes the developer experience discussion, I think, one level even lower. So, for example, what you're saying is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I have a property on an object, or maybe a method on an object, and I want to call that method. I'm going to go ahead and just call it, and then I'm going to write a unit test that tests the object, and it's going to call that method. And assuming everything works as intended, I've effectively type checked like the name of that method, yeah. Right?
You've type checked the method enough to where your code is.
Yeah, and like again, I would agree. The cycle, the iteration cycle, I would argue again is like an order of magnitude, maybe even two order of magnitudes faster if when I'm typing the function in the first place, I'm getting autocomplete. I'm getting assurances through my editor that these things exist, that I didn't misspell them, right? So I don't have to go through just, you know, the 10 minutes, the 20 minutes, the half hour of writing the unit tests, trying to find all the different test cases, again, just to make sure that the types are there. We recently migrated.
So here's the difference between what you're describing and what I usually do at work. I'm usually not trying to sling everything in the editor at the same time. I'm usually spending about just as much time in the Python debugger that actually gives you a runtime sandbox of the object that you have in the Python interpreter. And instead of having the definition of the type in my editor, I have both the code that was executed and as well in a separate process, the debugger that actually gives me the full object and the full scope of that object in the call stack. So instead of just spending all of my time in the text editor that's giving me all of these autocomplete, I'm writing a unit of code. I'm executing that in debugger. Again, this is dynamic language, so there's no compile time to wait for. Drop into the scope of the function, make sure that I have the object that I am expecting to have, and then I write a little bit of more code. And I'm kind of doing this back and forth between the debugger and the text editor in order to actually get my code to line up. And that's how you actually get into really big, complex Python projects. You know, one of the questions that you raised earlier is, how do you just hop into a large Python project and start being productive? Well, my approach is to start with the test suite, you know, find the sort of unit integration and end-to-end tests that actually execute a bit of functionality that I'm hoping to work with, and then just drop into a debugger at the point of implementation. In doing this, you may not have the type definition in your editor, but instead you have the full object representation in scope with the entire call stack to boot in the debugger as a wrapper. And since this is Python, you can do things right in the debugger, like list all the attributes and methods available objects, you know, you can collect the local and global scope of variables currently in scope, and even hop up and down the call stack to see if there's some data somewhere that you need in order to fix the bug. So the workflow in Python that leans heavily on this, you know, John Carmack style of debugging in tandem with the test suite is where you're going to have a better development experience, in my opinion.
So I want to be clear. I think everyone listening to this should really listen to what you're saying here, because it's actually really important. If you're building large Python projects, like, I couldn't agree more. There's probably not a better way than to be like in the debugger, in runtime, checking what's there and what's not, because you're getting effectively the same types of assurances that you would get in a statically typed language without running the code at all. And like you said, you're going to have more robust test suites in dynamically typed languages. In fact, I've started putting two and two together over the last few years of like, it tends to be people that spend a lot of time in statically typed languages that aren't as heavy on their unit tests and don't practice strict test-driven development. At least this is like me anecdotally observing all the different people I talk to. Whereas the people that are like really into Python or Ruby tend to be really heavy on unit tests. And my guess is it's because you have to test your types, right? And you'd be crazy not to, because that's like where, frankly, most bugs come from. Just like, I shipped some code and like, this thing is nil, right? Or this thing is null, or this thing doesn't exist, or this thing is none. Like tons of bugs crop up from those types of errors, even in statically typed languages.
Well, most of the bugs that I tend to work on day to day in terms of like going back to ETL pipelines are the third party API changed something in their JSON that my ETL pipeline doesn't know how to handle anymore. So it's actually going to give me a warning and say, hey, I don't know how to handle this. We're going to stop right now. Could you come look at it? And the way you debug something like that in a dynamic language like Python is you go ahead and write some sort of functionality that allows you to test this thing locally. Compress that down into a test that allows you to get fast iterative cycles, drop into the debugger at the point where it's actually failing, look at this new type, add some functionality to your ETL pipeline that allows you to handle this type, and then you're shipping it in like 20 minutes.
So this is, I think, one of the best use cases for statically typed languages. What I would do in this case is, let's just assume, is it like a JSON API? Are you like consuming JSON objects, or is it?
So it's usually JSON, some XML for your metadata, and then CSV, and again,
okay.
For your data, you have these two API endpoints that your ETL pipeline is going to hit. It's going to get data back, and you need to do that transformation from their schema to our schema. And then sometimes those things will fall over because they made an update to their API. We need to be able to update our ETL pipeline to handle the update that they just put.
Yeah. So let me explain what the workflow would look like in for example in Go, which like my job for a long time was I worked kind of consuming social media data from like tons of different social media sites like Reddit and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. They all have their different stupid APIs, and we have to like munge all that data into our own format. Sounds like very similar to what you're doing. What I do is like I'd call the endpoint and I'd get the JSON structure, and then I just paste it into my JSON to Go struct tool. It would generate my struct. I'd plop that into my program, and all of a sudden I have a ton of errors in my editor on like, you know, I just changed the structure of what I'm trying to parse. Now I go resolve all those errors, and like 99% of the time it works perfectly. because like I just have all of the assurances that all of these different properties exist. I see all of the red files in my editor where like I just created a bunch of breaking changes and I can go resolve them one by one. We just went through this pain on the front end of boot dev where we've been migrating from JavaScript to TypeScript. And we literally just like fixed bugs that we didn't even know existed, like tiny little edge case bugs, by modeling all of the API responses that our front end was consuming from our back end in TypeScript interfaces. Because, you know, you just like model the interface and then all of a sudden you have all these, again, like red squigglies in a bunch of different lines. You're like, a bunch of different files. You're like, oh crap, I assumed that this was this thing, but it's actually this other thing. At the end of the day, I think the only way to form your own opinion, which is what I think everyone listening to this podcast should do, is to like do both. And that's why like on boot dev, I love starting people in Python and then introducing them to Go, because you get a much more well-rounded experience as a developer working in both paradigms.
Okay, so I have a question for you now. When you were doing that work where you were hitting someone's third-party API and getting data, you said you were just dumping that into a type system and then using those types throughout your process to actually do your development.
Yeah.
How often are you actually hitting that API endpoint?
It depends. Like with Twitter, we were consuming anywhere from like 100 to 1,000 tweets a second. Reddit was maybe a few hundred, and then it like really dropped off because we also like consumed blogs through like RSS and stuff like that.
Were you always hitting that API endpoint when you were doing your development, or did you turn around and hit that API endpoint just a few times enough to where you were generating a mock that you could use instead to do your development against?
Sorry, I want you to ask that again so I make sure I understand the whole question.
So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to tie this into a discussion just to give you some context of mocking. And so the question was, are you hitting that API endpoint every time you need to simulate a API request against Twitter, or are you doing something else like creating a mock that allows you to do all of that testing locally without actually hitting that API?
Got it. So I'm effectively creating a mock, right? I'm getting some like JSON data that if I wanted to, I could then like paste into a unit test and use as like a thing to parse for my unit test, right? I expect this payload. Now I can parse it and test against the types.
Right. And that's basically what we have to do also in our Python backend. This is where we can get into the conversation of whether or not we like to use mocks or not. One of the things that we mock, and I don't see a better way to do it in Python other than to mock, is to mock the session object that takes an API request and turns it into a file system request that will actually read the data from the file system instead of making an API endpoint or API request against a third party. So literally, you know, you have in Python, you have this request, request.session object that has your get, your post, your delete, your methods like that. But in testing, we will pass our integrations, our ETL pipeline, a mock of that session.
Yeah.
And it knows how to take the API endpoint request that you're making and turn that into a file system read. And it returns you a response object that has the same attributes that the response object from the request library has. It has like your .text, it has your .context, it has your .content, it has your iter content, allow you to iterate over this lazily. Yeah. Getting us into the next conversation of whether or not we like mocks, I do think that there are some instances where a mock is necessary, because at the end of the day, when you're developing these robust test suites, you know, if you're testing your endpoint, you know, in your article, you were talking about separating functionality based off of you have your validation and you have your DB, your database query, and you can only test one part. But at the end of the day, there is one function that is going to call both, and that is your API. So if you're doing an API, if you're testing end to end based off of your API, you're making a response, and for our tests, we will actually spin up a web server that our tests will actually hit, given an API endpoint, given the data that our front end is actually going to make a request to, it's going to go through that whole end to end process. And during testing, we want to make sure that we pass a mock of that session object, that we're not actually hitting our third-party APIs every time we run the test suite, because then they'd be pissed at us for streaming like 12 gigabytes of CSV data today. It's like, what the heck?
Right. Yeah. So like hitting third-party APIs during like unit test suites, generally a bad idea. Hitting local databases can be a better or worse idea, I think, depending on like how hard it is to spin up your database, right? Like if you depend on like a proprietary Oracle database running the cloud, like that's probably a non-starter. Maybe if you have like an embedded SQLite database, it's not as a big deal. But first of all, I want to define what I mean when I say mocks, because we might be talking about different things. And whenever I have this conversation with people online, I find very quickly that people have different definitions in their heads. So you'll often hear the terms like mocks, fakes, and stubs. And sometimes they're used interchangeably. Sometimes people have like really specific academic definitions for each one, but like, I don't care about that. What I mean when I say a mock is I have some large function, like you said, maybe an API endpoint that has some dependencies on usually IO, right? So like input output. So to a, like database calls over the network, or like you said, a third party API call like Twitter or something. And when I say a mock, what I mean is there's some, in Go, it would be an interface. In Python, it would probably be an object that has knowledge of like how to go out to the database and get data, right? Or how to go out to Twitter and make, you know, a GET request to pull some data down. And in production, that object is going to actually reach out to, say, Twitter or the database. Whereas in a test suite that's using mocks, it will kind of intrinsically generate whatever the thing is. So like you said, maybe like a copy-pasted version of the expected JSON output, right? That's what the mock is going to generate. So
yeah, we're basically talking about dependency injection.
Yeah.
Instead of in production, you're going to send the actual session object, but in testing, you're going to send a mock session.
Exactly. Yep.
I think we're talking about the same. We're talking about the same thing. I'm just saying that in testing, when you don't want to actually hit that API endpoint, but you're going to run that end-to-end test, you have to mock somewhere. And one of the things that we do for mocking, and when the API endpoint is actually, or when our API, when you make a request against our API and we have to go make a third party API request, is it has a mock session instead of an actual.
So,
but in production, it has an actual.
Yeah,
session.
So I think we test the exact same way. And I think we test the exact same level of robustness, at least theoretically in our different paradigms. My argument is that instead of writing a unit test for the whole API endpoint, right, and injecting essentially an object that can be this or that, right, a real one or a fake one. Mm-hmm. Instead, you just write unit tests, like you write actual unit tests rather than integration tests, and you test the part that you actually care about, right? So if you have a function that goes and grabs data from Twitter, does some sort of transformation, and then shoves it in the database, instead of testing that whole function and stubbing out two of the sections with parts that don't actually run in production, so you're not actually testing them in any meaningful way, you're just testing the middle part. Instead, just test the middle part, because now you don't have like a false sense of security that your whole API endpoint is tested in the sense that like, I've tested this, when I run it in production, it will work the same way. Just test the code that you wrote by mocking it, right? So I'll still take that JSON blob and use it in my unit tests. It's just that my unit tests will like have a hard-coded JSON blob, call the two transformation functions, make sure that I get the expected output, and that's all it does, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, again, you know, like Lane was saying, you got to go try these things for yourself. And for, you know, this is how we've been doing it at Crunch for the last 3 years, you know, having these dependency injections for mocks that you're saying not to do. I've never had a problem with it.
It's so and this is just like, again, I'm going to like start stereotyping people here. In my experience, people that work in like super object oriented paradigms tend to be more fans of dependency injections and mocks. Like Java developers love their dependency injections. In my experience, people that work in more functional or procedural languages like Go, Rust, we tend to have this more like unit first approach to testing, where it's like, I just want to test this thing. Do I really have to mock an entire object with a bunch of fake functionality? Can I just test the thing I wrote? And like you said, try it both ways. The worst thing you could do, in my opinion, is to listen to people on YouTube or podcasts and just take their word for it. You got to try this stuff.
Yeah, and have a strong opinion that's loosely
held. Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, if you come along across a new functionality or a new paradigm that you prefer better, switch.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, I think both of these ways of doing it results in exactly the same amount of actual code covered in terms of like, I know when I run the test suite that I can trust that the things are working the way I expect them to. The difference is, in my mind, is really just how I'm scaffolding the test suite. Like, I think one way is much simpler and easier to get scaffolded.
Well, you're also saying don't test the API endpoint. And I would say that you should test the API endpoint. You know, the way that we do this at at Crunch is we spin up an actual web server and we're actually making API requests. Now your argument is, well, your mock session actually does, you can't guarantee that the data that it's returning is going to be the same way that the actual API request is going to act. So you're given a false sense of security in that, in faking that. I'm saying that that's not my experience.
Well, I want to be clear. You can still, like, if you're talking about integration tests, I'm still a huge fan of integration tests. I just usually separate them from my unit tests because my unit tests are something they're like, I can run them really quick. It's like a test suite that runs in like a second. There's no setup or teardown time. It's like when I write a new function that does something pretty, you know, self-contained in memory, right? Hopefully a pure function, huge fan of pure functions. I can just like add it to my test suite, run it. It's really quick. Whereas integration tests, I look at as something a lot more end to end. But again, like with my integration tests, I still want to kind of be mirroring production as much as I can. So I'll usually have like a staging database that I've seeded with data that I can test against. I am spinning up the API and testing. It's just like a different approach, almost based on like how much work it is to get the suite set up. Okay, so we talked about mocks, we talked about dynamic types. The last thing I want to make sure that we cover in this episode is Python being slow. So I'm just going to like start the conversation by accusing Python of being slow. What do you got to say about that, Michael?
I'm going to say guilty as charged. You know, Python is obviously slow. When you're trying to do specifically like numeric operations, like pushing it down into something like the C layer is going to be way better for you. So about a month ago, Theo, if you're on Twitter, it's t3.gg, did a video titled Performance Doesn't Matter Until It Does, in which he diagrammed this 2D axis of speed of iteration versus tons of traffic. And Theo's argument was that TypeScript provide an ecosystem where you can iterate quickly and early. And then eventually, as your traffic increases, you hit this fabled, you know, line of prime, where it makes sense to consider a rewrite in a language like Rust, Go, or using a developer of the caliber of the Primogen after you've sort of nailed down that core functionality of your application and need it to be more, you need it to be able to execute in a more performant manner. But when I look at that iteration versus traffic graph, what really stands out to me is how much of a great framework that graph is for addressing this question of Python's performance problem. You see, Python, when you start out building your application, all of your code is written in this highly dynamic language, which provides you the benefit of these fast iterations. And since your early development cycle, it's a trade-off that you want to make because there's such a first mover advantage to software development. And it's really hard to not have those fast iterations to benefit from for early on. So as you start product development, performance really isn't an issue. But that being said, as you start increasing traffic and increasing application load, Python also provides the ability to take these pieces of performance critical functionality and extract that out into these dynamically loaded extension modules written in either C or C++ or even Rust in some cases using libraries like Py03. And these hook directly into the interpreter runtime itself. So the result here is you get this ability to incrementally improve your application without having to resort to, say, adding a network boundary or doing a full rewrite. So the answer to the question of when is this a problem? Well, it's not a problem until it is, but luckily Python provides you with the hooks necessary to address these performance problems when they arise.
Yeah. So like generally speaking, like I just agree. If anyone's ever used like a lot of my students, for example, like look into machine learning or artificial intelligence, like, you know, tools like TensorFlow. Those big projects, like you think about it, you're like machine learning, like that sounds like it would be pretty compute intense. Like why is Python the most popular language? And it's like, it's in my opinion, it's for two simple reasons. First, like all that crap's actually written in C under the hood, right? And it's just a Python API that you can like pip install and then run. And then like, God rest your soul when you run the Python code and it's like, oh, all these dynamically loaded C libraries don't exist on your operating system. Good luck finding them and getting them to work. Aside from that problem, it works great. Like you can write very minimal Python code, get a ton of power coming from these C-level libraries under the hood. When it comes to web development, I haven't seen... Well, let me give you an example. So a couple companies ago, I worked at this company where we were ingesting large amounts of social media data, doing transformations on the data and shoving it in a database. That application was originally written in Ruby, which like vanilla Ruby and vanilla Python are very comparable in terms of execution speed. They're both interpreted languages. People love the syntax. They tend to be really slow. We saved a lot of money by rewriting those computational pieces in Go. And I would argue a lot of developer experience. I really, really prefer writing Go, but that's a different discussion. But the only other option I think we would have had, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the only other thing we could have done was go write like extensions for our Python code in C or Rust or something, and then plugged it in.
Yeah, at the end of the, I can even give an example of one of the ways that we do this at Crunch with our ETL pipelines. One of the things we do is parsing CSV files, and typically involves taking a metadata API endpoint and a data API endpoint, and then parsing those two entities out into an internal JDSL representation of our analytics engine that is, internal JDSL, JSON domain-specific language that our analytics engine is designed to work with. And this is something that our integrations have to do basically all the time, because the typical data format that these third-party APIs like to use is CSV. So the first iteration of this ETL pipeline was just using off-the-shelf tooling to get something spun up quickly. We originally were using pandas to ingest CSV files, parse them out by column, and then write the data to our JDSL. As we started onboarding customers to this new integration, we saw the need to iterate to a more robust implementation that could handle these larger file sizes. Although pandas could do the job, it really wasn't the optimal tool to use for our use case because of the large overhead it incurs in terms of both memory and execution performance. And it provides a lot of functionality that we didn't really need. So the second iteration, one of my colleagues, Chris Perkins, wrote an updated CSV parser that made use of some Python, some Cython, building around this idea of index and commas in the file, and then opening that CSV file into a memory map NumPy file. So that was better. It got rid of a lot of the overhead, but it still had this issue where in some cases your indexes were like bigger than the data file itself. You know, for example, your index value of 65,500. If your index is unsigned, you need to store that in like UN32 type in order to store that value in memory, but that's 4 bytes of memory that you're using to store.
And really quick, can you define what an index is for some of our listeners?
Yes. So an index is basically the number that you would have to go through an array in order to find the value that you're looking for. So for example, the index 5 is going to be the fifth character in that CSV file, and that if there's a comma on the fifth character, the index of 5 is pointing.
So
to
in
that
this
comma.
Example,
so yeah. Instead of having something that runs sequentially and have to search for all of them, you have a list of indexes that say, okay, there's a comma at 1, 5, 7, 11, and you just have all those in memory, or in this case, in memory.
Got it. Wow. So to improve speed of computation, you're building up this big in-memory index so that your algorithm's faster, but you're saying that the indexes actually started to kind of bloat memory and take up so much space in memory that maybe there was a trade-off to consider?
Yeah, so that was the second iteration. So then I came around and took that implementation, rewrote it in C, stripped out a bunch of the business logic that could really be implemented on top of a strict parser, and then did some optimizations for indexing. For example, I was indexing commas in the CSV file, but using this comma index to figure out the bits which represented the field value. But there's two edge cases where that approach is a pain to work with. The first edge case is the fact that on Windows, the CSV file will be written with a two-character new line, with a /r/n. On Linux, it's /n. On Mac OS, it's /r, and it's just kind of a pain, so it kind of ruins your indexing. But it turns out that during the second iteration of the library called Lazy CSV, we also added a secondary index that would limit our field index to types of UN16 type in order to save on space. And it does all this using memory maps. So the parser basically takes up essentially 0 RAM. So this latest iteration of our parser was super fast. It was lean. It had 0 dependencies, which we did make NumPy an optional compile time dependency. So if you wanted to manipulate an interval out of an array, you could do that. And since we separated out the business logic from the parser, we went ahead and open sourced that library, and that can actually be found on our company's GitHub repo if you wanted to go take a look at one of the results of being able to iteratively improve a library that we had for parsing out CSV files. We originally had a Python version, then we had the Python Cython, and now we have a complete C version, which is actually probably the fastest parser out there for parsing large CSV
files. That's super cool. That sounds like a really fun experience to have to like get down in the weeds that much. Not every backend developer, I mean, I feel like at some point in all of our careers as backend developers, we're going to be working on performance, but it's not always to that degree, right? A lot of times you can solve big problems even while staying in Python, but clearly in this example, like, no, you had to jump into the C code and write an extension for your Python code, which I think is great. I mean, obviously there is the huge drawback that, like, if that's part of your day-to-day workflow, you need all of your Python developers to also be like C or Rust developers in order to get that same level of performance. At least you get to keep, I mean, the benefit obviously being you get to keep the nice Python API at the top.
Yeah, and one of the benefits of doing it in C, you know, like I said, you can also do it in like C++ and Rust, but one of the benefits that we found from using C as our extension language was that the workflow that you use in Python, you know, this idea of dropping into a debugger and inspecting the call stack, it also works in C using the GNU debugger, and you can actually run those at the same time. So you have breakpoints in senior C extensions that you can stop at the GNU debugger while the GNU debugger is actually running your Python test. So you have breakpoints in Python, you have breakpoints in C, and everything just works kind of synergistically, which is really nice.
Yeah. Thanks so much for that explanation. I think that was hopefully really helpful to my students, and it's something that I think people should play with. In my experience, most people kind of fall into one of two categories when it comes to debugging and like developer iteration. And a lot of that will be influenced by like the language, the framework, the domain that you're working in. For example, like me working on the web, TypeScript on the front end, Go on the back end, I tend to not use a debugger very often unless there's like a really hairy problem I need to solve, because most of my work is done in statically typed land where I can kind of just write the code, run the server very quickly because Go has compile times of like 1 second or whatever, make sure that it worked, and maybe write a unit test if there's something like nice, some nice pure transformation there that I want to test. And like that's generally speaking my developer experience. But like, for example, John Carmack, a developer that's way more experienced and way better than me, but also is his domain is kind of game development, and you coming from the Python world, like very debugger heavy from my experience, right? You're spinning up a debugger, you're in the middle of the code. My understanding is like, if your application is super stateful, that can also be really helpful. Like imagine you're writing a video game and like you're trying to debug this very specific case where like, I don't know, when you hit somebody with this sword as this unit, there's a problem. It's like you have to get your application into that state before you can like debug it effectively. And so it makes sense to me to use a debugger, set a breakpoint, and look into those things. So I love that everybody can hear your take on this.
Yeah, at the end of the day, trying to wrap this all up, it's the idea of iteratively improving your application being fully borne out in this example. You know, first iteration, just get some of the ship. Second iteration, you start gaming out with what sort of functionality you can improve in your code, and then just iterating until you have this tight unit that's performant and you didn't throw away the rest of your app in the meantime doing a full rewrite.
Completely agree. Awesome. Michael Green, I mean, obviously you're the author of Zero to Pi. Tell people where they can find your book.
That's fine. We don't need to
We don't need to go into the details on it, but I want you to tell people where they can find you, where they can follow you, and where they can find your book.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, mg.dev. Sorry if I've changed it a few times over the last week or so. I don't know if you noticed.
I actually haven't, but
so just trying to crystallize on a specific domain, a specific tag, and I didn't like the one that I've been stuck with for the longest time. So mg.dev on Twitter, on Threads, and the book that I wrote, if you want to get into this, the basic idea being finding a golden thread that allows you to get from understanding nothing to all the way down to how can I debug these C extensions using this robust testing and debugging platform paradigm. The book is called Zero to Pi. It's on the LeanPub platform. One of the benefits that I found of publishing with that is that if you get the book through that platform, you get all the future iterations. So the plan is to publish a new version of the book with every release of the minor Python interpreter. So 3.12 is going to come out in a few months. There's going to be a new version of that. You get on LeanPub, you're going to get that version for free. So, you know, at the end of the day, you're not going to have this book that you purchased and it's going to go out of date in 3 years and you're going to have to buy a new one. That's not a problem. And listeners to this podcast, boot.dev, can go to leanpub.com/zerotopi/c/boot.dev, and there will be a 60% discount.
Amazing.
That book.
Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Yeah, hey, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me. It was fun to get some banter going.